play ball with him. I get too distracted.
Will you at least talk to me? Chris asks.
Defense, Carter! Coach yells.
I focus on the ball and attempt to steal. Not quick enough. He gets around me and goes straight for the hoop, only to pass it to Jackson, who's open at the three-point line.
Grant!
Coach shouts for Haley. Haley runs over. Her fingertips graze the ball as it leaves Jackson's hand, changing its course. The ball goes flying. I go running. I catch it. Chris is behind me, the only thing between me and the hoop. Let me clarify. My butt is against his crotch, my back against his chest. I'm bumping up against him, trying to figure out how to get the ball in the hole. It sounds way dirtier than it actually is, especially in this position. I understand why Bridget missed shots, though.
Star!
Haley calls. She's open at the three. I bounce past it to her. She shoots. Nails it. 5-0.
Come on, boys! Maya taunts. Is that all you can do?
Coach claps.
Good job! Good job!
Jackson's at the baseline. He passes to Chris. Chris chest passes it back to him.
I don't get it, Chris says. You practically freaked out the other day in the hall. What's going on?
Garrett passes to Chris. I get in my defensive stance. Eyes on the ball, not on Chris. Cannot look at Chris. My eyes will give me away.
Talk to me, he says.
I attempt to steal again. No luck. Play the game, I say. Chris goes left, quickly changes direction, and goes right. I try to stay on him, but my heavy stomach slows me down. He gets to the hoop and makes the layup. It's good. 5-2.
Damn it, Star!
Haley yells, recovering the ball. She passes it to me.
Hustle! Pretend the ball is some fried chicken. Bet you'll stay on it then.
What? The actual fuck. The world surges forward without me. I hold the ball and stare at Haley as she jogs away, blue-streaked hair bouncing behind her.
I can't believe she said...
She couldn't have. No way. The ball falls out my hands. I walk off the court. I'm breathing hard, and my eyes burn. The smell of post-game funk lingers in the girls' locker room. It's my place of solace when we lose a game, where I can cry or cuss if I want. I pace from one side of the lockers to the other. Haley and Maya rush in, out of breath.
What's up with you?
Haley asks.
Me?
I say, my voice bouncing off the lockers.
What the hell was that comment?
Lighten up. It was only game talk.
A fried chicken joke was only game talk? Really?
I ask.
It's fried chicken day,
she says.
You and Maya were just joking about it. What are you trying to say?
I keep pacing. Her eyes widen. Oh, my God.
You think I was being racist?
I look at her. You made a fried chicken comment to the only black girl in the room. What do you think?
Holy shit, Star. Seriously? After everything we've been through, you think I'm a racist? Really?
You can say something racist and not be a racist. Is something else going on, Star? Maya says.
Why does everyone keep asking me that?
I snap.
Because you're acting so weird lately.
Haley snaps back. She looks at me and asks, does this have something to do with the police shooting that drug dealer in your neighborhood?
What?
I heard about it on the news, she says. And I know you're into that sort of thing now.
That sort of thing? What the fuck is that sort of thing?
And then they said the drug dealer's name was Khalil, she says, and exchanges a look with Maya.
We've wanted to ask if it was the Khalil who used to come to your birthday parties, Maya adds. We didn't know how, though.
The drug dealer. That's how they see him. It doesn't matter that he's suspected of doing it. Drug dealer is louder than suspected ever will be. If it's revealed that I was in the car, what will that make me? The thug ghetto girl with the drug dealer? What will my teachers think about me? My friends? The whole fucking world, possibly. I close my eyes. Khalil stares at the sky.
Mind your business, Star, he says.
I swallow and whisper. I don't know that, Khalil. It's a betrayal worse than dating a white boy. I fucking deny him. Damn near erasing every laugh we shared, every hug, every tear, every second we spent together. A million I'm sorries sound in my head. And I hope they reach Khalil, wherever he is. Yet they'll never be enough. But I had to do it. I had to.
Then what is it? Haley asks. Is this like Natasha's anniversary or something?
I stare at the ceiling and blink fast to keep from bawling. Besides my brothers and the teachers, Haley and Maya are the only people at Williamson who know about Natasha. I don't want all the pity. Mom's anniversary was a few weeks ago, Haley says. I was in a shitty mood for days. I understand if you're upset, but to accuse me of being racist, Star, how can you even? I blink faster. God, I'm pushing her away, Chris away. Hell, do I deserve them? I don't talk about Natasha, and I just flat out denied Khalil. I could have been the one killed instead of them. I don't have the decency to keep their memories alive, yet I'm supposed to be their best friend. I cover my mouth. It doesn't stop the sob. It's loud and echoes off the walls. One follows it, and another, and another. Maya and Haley rub my back and shoulders. Coach Myers rushes in.
Carter?
Haley looks at her and says, Natasha. Coach nods heavily.
Carter, go see Ms. Lawrence.
What? No. She's sending me to the school shrink? All the teachers know about poor Star, who saw her friend die when she was 10. I used to bust out crying all the time, and that was always their go-to line. See Ms. Lawrence. I wipe my eyes. Coach, I'm okay.
No, you're not.
She pulls a hall pass from her pocket and holds it toward me.
Go talk to her. It'll help you feel better.
No, it won't. But I know what will. I take the pass, grab my backpack out my locker, and go back into the gym. My classmates follow me with their eyes as I hurry toward the doors. Chris calls out for me. I speed up. They probably heard me crying. Great. What's worse than being the angry black girl? The weak black girl. By the time I get to the main office, I've dried my eyes and my face completely.
Good afternoon, Ms. Carter,
Dr. Davis, the headmaster, says. He's leaving as I'm going in and doesn't wait for my response. Does he know all the students by name, or just the ones who are black, like him? I hate that I think about stuff like that now. His secretary, Mrs. Lindsay, greets me with a smile and asks how she can assist me. I need to call someone to come get me, I say. I don't feel good. I call Uncle Carlos. My parents would ask too many questions. A limb has to be missing for them to take me out of school. I only have to tell Uncle Carlos that I have cramps, and he'll pick me up. Feminine problems. The key to ending an Uncle Carlos interrogation. Luckily, he's on lunch break. He signs me out, and I hold my stomach for added effect. As we leave, he asks if I want some froyo. I say, yeah, and a short while later we're going into a shop that's walking distance from Williamson. It's in a brand new mini mall that should be called Hipster Heaven, full of stores you'd never find in Garden Heights. On one side of the Froyo place, there's Indie Urban Style, and on the other side, Dapper Dog, where you can buy outfits for your dog. Clothes. For a dog. What kind of fool would I be, dressing bricks in a linen shirt and jeans? On a serious tip, white people are crazy for their dogs. We fill our cups with yogurt. At the toppings bar, Uncle Carlos breaks out into his Froyo rap. I'm getting Froyo-yo, Froyo-yo-yo. He loves his Froyo. It's kind of adorable. We take a booth in a corner that's got a lime green table and hot pink seats. You know, typical Froyo decor. Uncle Carlos looks over into my cup. Did you seriously ruin perfectly good Froyo with Cap'n Crunch? You can't talk, I say. Oreos, Uncle Carlos? Really? And they're not even the golden Oreos, which are by far the superior Oreos. You got the regular ones. Ew. He devours a spoonful and says, you're weird. You're weird? So cramps, huh? He says. Shit, I almost forgot about that. I hold my stomach and groan. Yeah, they're real bad today. I know who won't win an Oscar anytime soon. Uncle Carlos gives me his hard detective stare. I groan again. This one sounds a little more believable. He raises his eyebrows. His phone rings in his jacket pocket. He sticks another spoonful of Froyo in his mouth and checks it. It's your mom calling me back, he says around the spoon. He holds the phone with his cheek and shoulder. Hey, Lisa, you get my message? Shit. She's not feeling good, Uncle Carlos says. She's got, you know, feminine problems. Her response is loud but muffled. Shit. Shit. Uncle Carlos holds the nape of his neck and slowly releases a long, deep breath. He turns into a little boy when Mama raises her voice at him, and he's supposed to be the oldest. Okay. Okay. I hear you, he says. Here, you talk to her. Shit, shit, shit. He passes me the piece of dynamite formerly known as his phone. There's an explosion of questioning as soon as I say, hello? Cramps, Star, really? She says. They're bad, Mommy, I whine, lying my butt off. Girl, please, I went to class in labor with you, she says. I pay too much money for you to go to Williamson so you can leave because of cramps. I almost point out that I get a scholarship, too, but nah. She'd become the first person in history to hit someone through a phone. Did something happen? She asks. No. Is it Khalil? She asks. I sigh. This time tomorrow, I'll be staring at him in a coffin. Star? She says. Nothing happened. Miss Felicia calls for her in the background. Look. I gotta go, she says. Carlos will take you home. Lock the door, stay inside, and don't let anybody in. You hear me? Those aren't zombie survival tips. Just normal instructions for latchkey kids in Garden Heights. I can't let Seven and Sakani in? Great. Oh, somebody's trying to be funny. Now I know you ain't feeling bad. We'll talk later. I love you. Mwah! It takes a lot of nerve to go off on somebody, call them out, and tell them you love them within a span of 5 minutes. I tell her I love her too, and pass Uncle Carlos his phone. All right, baby girl, he says, spill it. I stuff some Froyo in my mouth. It's melting already. Like I said,
cramps. I'm not buying that, and let's be clear about something. You only get one Uncle Carlo's get-me-out-of-school card per school year, and you're using it right now.
You got me in December, remember? For cramps also. I didn't lie about those. They were a bitch that day.
All right, one per calendar year, he clarifies.
I smile.
But you gotta give me a little more to work with, so talk.
I push Captain Crunch around my froyo. Khalil's funeral is tomorrow.
I know.
I don't know if I should go.
What? Why?
Because, I say, I hadn't seen him in months before the party.
You still should go, he says. You'll regret it if you don't. I thought about going. Not sure if that's a good idea, considering.
Silence. Are you really friends with that cop? I ask.
I wouldn't say friends, no. Colleagues.
But you're on a first-name basis, right?
Yes, he says.
I stare at my cup. Uncle Carlos was my first dad in some ways. Daddy went to prison around the time I realized that Mommy and Daddy weren't just names, but they meant something. I talked to Daddy on the phone every week, but he didn't want me and Seven to ever set foot in a prison, so I didn't see him. I saw Uncle Carlos, though. He fulfilled the role and then some. Once I asked if I could call him Daddy. He said no, because I already had one. But being my uncle was the best thing he could ever be. Ever since, Uncle has meant almost as much as Daddy. My uncle. On a first-name basis with that cop.
Baby girl, I don't know what to say.
His voice is gruff.
I wish I could. I'm sorry this happened. I am.
Why haven't they arrested him?
Cases like this are difficult.
It's not that difficult, I say. He killed Khalil.
I know, he says, and wipes his face. I know.
Would you have killed him? He looks at me.
Star, I can't answer that.
Yeah, you can.
No, I can't. I'd like to think I wouldn't have, but it's hard to say unless you're in that situation, feeling what that officer is feeling.
He pointed his gun at me, I blurt out.
What?
My eyes prickle like crazy. While we were waiting on help to show up, I say, my words wobbling. He kept it on me until somebody else got there, like I was a threat. I wasn't the one with the gun. Uncle Carlo stares at me for the longest time.
Baby girl.
He reaches for my hand. He squeezes it and moves to my side of the table. His arm goes around me and I bury my face in his rib cage, tears and snot wetting his shirt.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
He kisses my hair with each apology.
But I know that's not enough.
8. Funerals aren't for dead people. They're for the living. I doubt Khalil cares what songs are sung or what the preacher says about him. He's in a casket. Nothing can change that. My family and I leave 30 minutes before the funeral starts, but the parking lot at Christ Temple Church is already full. Some kids from Khalil's school stand around in R.I.P. Khalil t-shirts with his face on them. A guy tried to sell some to us yesterday, but Mama said we weren't wearing them today. T-shirts are for the streets, not for church. So here we are, getting out the car in our dresses and suits. My parents hold hands and walk in front of me and my brothers. We used to go to Christ Temple when I was younger, but Mama got tired of how people here act like their shit don't stank, and now we go to this diverse church in Riverton Hills.
Way too many people go there, and praise and worship is led by a white guy on guitar. Oh, and service lasts less than an hour. Going back in Christ Temple is like when you go back to your old elementary school after you've been to high school. When you were younger, it seemed big, but when you go back, you realize how small it is. People fill up the tiny foyer. It has cranberry-colored carpet and two burgundy high-back chairs. One time Mama brought me out here because I was acting up. She made me sit in one of those chairs and told me not to move until service was over. I didn't. A painting of the pastor hung above the chairs, and I could have sworn he was watching me. All these years later, and they still have that creepy painting up. There's a line to sign a book for Khalil's family, and another line to go into the sanctuary to see him. I catch a glimpse of the white casket at the front of the sanctuary, but I can't make myself try to see more than that. I'll see him, eventually, but I don't know. I want to wait until I don't have any other choice. Pastor Eldridge greets people in the doorway of the sanctuary. He's wearing a long white robe with gold crosses on it. He smiles at everyone. I don't know why they made him look so creepy in that painting. He's not creepy at all. Mama glances back at me, Seven and Sakani, like she's making sure we look nice. Then she and Daddy go up to Pastor Eldridge. Morning, Pastor. She says,
Lisa, so good to see you.
He kisses her cheek and shakes Daddy's hand.
Maverick, good to see you as well. We miss y'all around here.
I bet y'all do,
Daddy mumbles. Another reason we left Christ Temple. Daddy doesn't like that they take up so many offerings, but he doesn't even go to our diverse church.
And these must be the children.
Pastor Eldridge says. He shakes Seven's and Sakani's hands and kisses my cheek. I feel more of his bristly mustache than anything.
Y'all sure have grown since I last saw you. I remember when the little one was an itty-bitty thing wrapped up in a blanket. How's your mama doing, Lisa?
She's good. She misses coming here, but the drive is a little long for her. I side-eye the hell, excuse me, heck, we're in church, out of her. Nana stopped coming to Christ Temple because of some incident between her and Mother Wilson over Deacon Rankin. It ended with Nana storming off from the church picnic, banana pudding in hand. That's all I know, though.
We understand, says Pastor Eldridge. Let her know we're praying for her.
He looks at me with an expression I know too well. Pity.
Miss Rosalie told me you were with Khalil when this happened. I'm so sorry you had to witness it.
Thank you. It's weird saying that, like I'm stealing sympathy from Khalil's family. Mama grabs my hand. We're gonna find some seats. Nice talking to you, Pastor. Daddy wraps his arm around me, and the three of us walk into the sanctuary together. My legs tremble, and a wave of nausea hits me, and we aren't even at the front of the viewing line yet. People go up to the casket in twos, so I can't see Khalil at all. Soon there are six people in front of us. Four. Two. I keep my eyes closed the whole time with the last two. Then it's our turn. My parents lead me up. Baby, open your eyes, Mama says. I do. It looks more like a mannequin than Khalil in the casket. His skin is darker, and his lips are pinker than they should be because of the makeup. Khalil would have had a fit if he knew they put that on him. He's wearing a white suit and a gold cross pendant. The real Khalil had dimples. This mannequin version of him doesn't. Mama brushes tears from her eyes. Daddy shakes his head. Seven and Sakani stare. That's not Khalil, I tell myself. Like it wasn't Natasha. Natasha's mannequin wore a white dress with pink and yellow flowers all over it. It had on makeup, too. Mama had told me, see, she looks asleep. But when I squeezed her hand, her eyes never opened. Daddy carried me out the sanctuary as I screamed for her to wake up. We move so the next set of people can look at Khalil's mannequin. An usher is about to direct us to some seats, but this lady with natural twists gestures toward the front row of the friend's side, right in front of her. No clue who she is, but she must be somebody if she's giving orders like that. And she must know something about me, if she thinks my family deserves the front row. We take our seats, and I focus on the flowers instead. There's a big heart made out of red and white roses, a K made out of calla lilies, and an arrangement of flowers in orange and green, his favorite colors. When I run out of flowers, I look at the funeral program. It's full of pictures of Khalil, from the time he was a curly-haired baby up until a few weeks ago with friends I don't recognize. There are pictures of me and him from years ago, and one with us and Natasha. All three of us smile, trying to look gangster with our peace signs. The hood trio, tighter than the inside of Voldemort's nose. Now I'm the only one left. I close the program.
Let us stand.
Pastor Eldridge's voice echoes throughout the sanctuary. The organist starts playing and everyone stands.
And Jesus said, "Do not let your hearts be troubled," he says, coming down the aisle. "You believe in God, believe also in me."
Miss Rosalie marches behind him. Cameron walks alongside her, gripping her hand. Tears stain his chubby cheeks. He's only 9. A year older than Sakani. Had one of those bullets hit me, that could have been my little brother crying like that. Khalil's Aunt Tammy holds Miss Rosalie's other hand. Miss Brenda is wailing behind them, wearing a black dress that once belonged to Mama. Her hair has been combed into a ponytail. 2 guys, I think they're Khalil's cousins, hold her up. It's easier to look at the casket.
My father's house has many rooms. If that were not so, would I have told you that I am going there to prepare a place for you?
Pastor Eldridge says.
And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am.
At Natasha's funeral, her mama passed out when she saw her in the casket. Somehow, Khalil's mama and grandma don't.
I want to make one thing clear today,
Pastor Eldridge says, once everyone is seated.
No matter the circumstances, this is a home-going celebration. Weeping may endure for a night, but how many of you know that joy?
He doesn't even finish, and people shout. The choir sings upbeat songs, and almost everyone claps and praises Jesus. Mama sings along and waves her hands. Khalil's grandma and auntie clap and sing, too. A praise break even starts, and people run around the sanctuary and do the Holy Ghost two-step, as Seven and I call it. Their feet moving like James Brown, and their bent arms flapping like chicken wings. But if Khalil's not celebrating, how the hell can they? And why praise Jesus, since he let Khalil get shot in the first place? I put my face in my hands, hoping to drown out the drums, the horns, the shouting. This shit doesn't make any sense. After all that praising, some of Khalil's classmates, the ones who were in the parking lot in the T-shirts, make a presentation. They give his family the cap and gown Khalil would have worn in a few months, and cry as they tell funny stories I'd never heard. Yet I'm the one in the front row on the friend's side. I'm such a fucking phony. Next, the lady with the twists goes up to the podium. Her black pencil skirt and blazer are more professional-looking than church-looking, and she's wearing an R.I.P. Khalil T-shirt, too. "Good morning," she says, and everyone responds. "My name is April Ofra, and I'm with Just Us for Justice. We are a small organization here in Garden Heights that advocates for police accountability. As we say farewell to Khalil, we find our hearts burdened with the harsh truth of how he lost his life. Just before the start of this service, I was informed that despite a credible eyewitness account, the police department has no intentions of arresting the officer who murdered this young man." "What?" I say, as people murmur around the sanctuary. "Everything I told them? And they're not arresting him?"
"What they don't want you to know," Miss Ofra says, "is that Khalil was unarmed at the time of his murder."
People really start talking then. A couple of folks yell out, including one person who's bold enough to shout, "This is bullshit!" in a church.
"We won't give up until Khalil receives justice," Miss Ofra says over the talking. "I ask you to join us and Khalil's family after the service for a peaceful march to the cemetery. Our route happens to pass the police station. Khalil was silenced, but let's join together and make our voices heard for him. Thank you."
The congregation gives her a standing ovation. As she returns to her seat, she glances at me. If Ms. Rosalie told the pastor I was with Khalil, she probably told this lady, too. I bet she wants to talk. Pastor Eldridge just about preaches Khalil into heaven. I'm not saying Khalil didn't make it to heaven. I don't know. But Pastor Eldridge tries to make sure he gets there. He sweats and breathes so hard I get tired looking at him. At the end of the eulogy, he says,
"If anybody wishes to view the body, now is the..."
He stares at the back of the church. Murmurs bubble around the sanctuary. Mama looks back. "What in the world?" King and a bunch of his boys post up in the back in their gray clothes and bandanas. King has his arm hooked around a lady in a tight black dress that barely covers her thighs. She has way too much weave in her head. For real. It comes to her ass. And way too much makeup on. Seven turns back around. I wouldn't want to see my mama looking like that either. But why are they here? King Lords only show up at King Lord funerals. Pastor Eldridge clears his throat.
"As I was saying, if anyone wishes to view the body, now is the time."
King and his boys swagger down the aisle. Everybody stares. Aisha walks alongside him, all proud and shit, not realizing she looks a hot mess. She glances at my parents and smirks, and I can't stand her ass. I mean, not just because of how she treats Seven, but because every time she shows up, there's suddenly an unspoken tension between my parents. Like now, Mama shifts her shoulder so it's not as close to Daddy, and his jaw is clenched. She's the Achilles heel of their marriage, and it's only noticeable if you've been watching it for 16 years, like I have. King, Aisha, and the rest of them go up to the casket. One of King's boys hands him a folded gray bandana, and he lays it across Khalil's chest. My heart stops. Khalil was a King Lord, too? Miss Rosalie jumps up.
"Like hell you will!"
She marches to the coffin and snatches the bandana off Khalil. She starts toward King, but Daddy catches her halfway and holds her back.
Get out of here, you demon!
She screams. And take this mess with you! She throws the bandana at the back of King's head. He stills. Slowly, he turns around.
Now look, bitch.
Hey!
Daddy says.
King man, just go. Leave, Ike.
Yo, hag,
Aisha snarls.
Got some nerve treating my man like this after he offered to pay for this funeral? He can keep his filthy money,
Miss Rosalie says.
And you can take your behind right out the door, too, coming in the Lord's house looking like the prostitute you are.
Seven shakes his head. It's no secret that my big brother is the result of a for-hire session Daddy had with Aisha after a fight with Mama. Aisha was King's girl, but he told her to hook Maverick up, not knowing Seven would come along looking exactly like Daddy. Fucked up, I know. Mama reaches behind me and rubs Seven's back. There are rare times when Seven's not around and Mama thinks Sekani and I can't hear her that she'll tell Daddy, I still can't believe you slept with that nasty hoe. But Seven can't be around. When he's around, none of that matters. She loves him more than she hates Aisha. The King Lords leave, and conversations break out all around. Daddy leads Miss Rosalie to her seat. She's so mad she's shaking. I look at the mannequin in the coffin. All those horror stories Daddy told us about gangbanging. And Khalil became a King Lord? How could he even think about doing that? It doesn't make sense, though. He had green in his car. That's what garden disciples do, not King Lords. And he didn't run to help out with the fight at Big D's party. But the bandana. Daddy once said that's a King Lord tradition. They crown their fallen comrades by putting a folded bandana on the body, as if to say they're going into heaven repping their set. Khalil must have joined to get that honor. I could have talked him out of it. I know it. But I abandoned him. Fuck the friend side. I shouldn't even be at his funeral. Daddy stays with Miss Rosalie for the rest of the service and later helps her when the family follows the casket out. Aunt Tammy motions us over to join them.
Thank you for being here, she tells me. You meant a lot to Khalil. I hope you know that.
My throat tightens too much for me to tell her he means a lot to me, too. We follow the casket with the family. Just about everyone we pass has tears in their eyes. For Khalil. He really is in that casket, and he's not coming back. I've never told anyone, but Khalil was my first crush. He unknowingly introduced me to stomach butterflies, and later heartbreak when he got his own crush on Imani Anderson, a high schooler who wasn't even thinking about fourth grade him. I worried about my appearance for the first time around him. But fuck the crush. He was one of the best friends I ever had, no matter if we saw each other every day or once a year. Time didn't compare to all the shit we went through together. And now he's in a casket. Like Natasha. Big fat tears fall from my eyes, and I sob. A loud, nasty, ugly sob that everybody hears and sees as I come up the aisle. They left me, I cry. Mama wraps her arm around me and presses my head onto her shoulder. I know, baby, but we're here. We aren't going anywhere. Warmth brushes my face and I know we're outside. All of the voices and noises make me look. There are more people out here than in the church, holding posters with Khalil's face on them and signs that say, Justice for Khalil. His classmates have posters saying, Am I next? And enough is enough. News vans with tall antennas are parked across the street. I bury my face in Mama's shoulder again. People, I don't know who, pat my back and tell me it'll be okay. I can tell when it's Daddy who's rubbing my back without him even saying anything.
"We gonna stay and march, baby," he tells Mama. "I want Seven and Sakani to be a part of this."
Yeah, I'm taking her home. How are y'all getting back?
"We can walk to the store. I gotta open up anyway."
He kisses my hair.
"I love you, baby girl. Get some rest, aight?"
Heels clack toward us. Then someone says,
"Hi, Mr. and Mrs. Carter. I'm April Ofra, with Just Us for Justice."
Mama tenses up and pulls me closer. "How may we help you?" She lowers her voice and says,
"Khalil's grandmother told me that Star is the one who was with Khalil when this happened. I know she gave a statement to the police, and I want to commend her on her bravery. This is a difficult situation, and that must have taken a lot of strength."
"Yeah, it did," Daddy says.
I move my head off Mama's shoulder. Miss Ofra shifts her weight from foot to foot and fumbles with her fingers. My parents aren't helping with the hard looks they're giving her.
"We all want the same thing," she says. "Justice for Khalil."
"Excuse me, Miss Ofra," Mama says. "But as much as I want that, I want my daughter to have some peace. And privacy." Mama looks at the news vans across the street. Miss Ofra glances back at them.
"Oh," she says. "Oh, no. No, no, no. We weren't. I don't want to put Star out there like that. Quite the opposite, actually. I want to protect her privacy."
Mama loosens her hold. "I see."
"Star offers a unique perspective in this, one you don't get a lot with these cases, and I want to make sure her rights are protected and that her voice is heard. But without her being
exploited,"
Daddy asks.
"Pimped?"
"Exactly. This case is about to gain national media attention, but I don't want it to be at her expense."
She hands each of us a business card.
"Besides being an advocate, I'm also an attorney. Just Us for Justice isn't providing the Harris family with legal representation. Someone else is doing that. We're simply rallying behind them. However, I'm available and willing to represent Star on my own. Whenever you're ready, please give me a call, and I am so sorry for your loss."
She disappears into the crowd. "Call her when I'm ready, huh? I'm not sure I'll ever be ready for the shit that's about to happen." 9. My brothers come home with a message. Daddy's spending the night at the store. He also leaves instructions for us. Stay inside. A chain-link fence surrounds our house. Seven puts the big lock on the gate, the one we use when we go out of town. I bring Bricks inside. He doesn't know how to act, walking around in circles and jumping on the furniture. Mama doesn't say anything until he gets on her good sofa in the living room.
"Hey!" she snaps her fingers at him. "Get your big behind off my furniture! You crazy?"
He whimpers and scurries over to me. The sun sets. We're in the middle of saying grace over pot roast and potatoes when the first gunshots ring out. We open our eyes. Sakani flinches. I'm used to gunshots, but these are louder, faster. One barely sounds off before another's right behind it.
"Machine guns," says Seven.
More shots follow. "Take your dinner to the den," Mama says, getting up from the table, "and sit on the floor. Bullets don't know where they're supposed to go." Seven gets up too.
"Ma, I can..."
"Seven, den," she says.
"But..."
"Seven!" She breaks his name down. "I'm turning the lights off, baby, okay? Please go to the den? He gives in.
All right.
When Daddy isn't home, Seven acts like he's the man of the house by default. Mama always has to break his name down and put him in his place. I grab my plate and Mama's and head for the den, the one room without exterior walls. Bricks is right behind me, but he always follows food. The hallway darkens as Mama turns off the lights throughout the house. We have one of those old-school big-screen TVs in the den. It's Daddy's prized possession. We crowd around it, and Seven turns on the news, lighting up the den. There are at least 100 people gathered on Magnolia Avenue. They chant for justice and hold signs, fists high in the air for black power. Mama comes in, talking on the phone. All right, Mrs. Pearl, as long as you're sure. Just remember, we got enough room over here for you if you don't feel comfortable being alone. I'll check in later. Mrs. Pearl is this elderly lady who lives by herself across the street. Mama checks on her all the time. She says Mrs. Pearl needs to know that somebody cares. Mama sits next to me. Sikani rests his head in her lap. Bricks mimics him and puts his head in my lap, licking my fingers.
Are they mad 'cause Khalil died?
Sikani asks. Mama brushes her fingers through his high-top fade. Yeah, baby. We all are. But they're really mad that Khalil was unarmed. Can't be a coincidence this is happening after Miss Ofra announced that at his funeral. The cops respond to the chants with tear gas that blankets the crowd in a white cloud. The news cuts to footage inside the crowd of people running and screaming. Damn, Seven says. Sikani buries his face in Mama's thigh. I feed Bricks a piece of my pot roast. The clenching in my stomach won't let me eat. Sirens wail outside. The news shows 3 patrol cars that have been set ablaze at the police precinct, about a 5-minute drive away from us. A gas station near the freeway gets looted, and the owner, this Indian man, staggers around bloody, saying he didn't have anything to do with Khalil's death. A line of cops guard the Walmart on the east side. My neighborhood is a war zone. Chris texts to see if I'm okay, and I immediately feel like shit for avoiding him, Beyonce-ing him, and everything else. I would apologize, but texting I'm sorry, combined with every emoji in the world, isn't the same as saying it face to face. I do let him know I'm okay, though. Maya and Haley call, asking about the store, the house, my family, me. Neither of them mention the fried chicken drama. It's weird talking to them about Garden Heights. We never do. I'm always afraid one of them will call it the ghetto. I get it. Garden Heights is the ghetto, so it wouldn't be a lie. But it's like when I was 9 and Seven and I got into one of our fights. He went for a low blow and called me Shorty McShortShort. A lame insult now when I think about it, but it tore me up back then. I knew there was a possibility I was short. Everybody else was taller than I was, and I could call myself short if I wanted. It became an uncomfortable truth when Seven said it. I can call Garden Heights the ghetto all I want. Nobody else can. Mama stays on her phone, too, checking on some neighbors and getting calls from others who are checking on us. Miss Jones down the street says that she and her 4 kids are holed up in their den like we are. Mr. Charles next door says that if the power goes out, we can use his generator. Uncle Carlos checks on us, too. Nana takes the phone and tells Mama to bring us out there, like we're about to go through the shit to get out of it. Daddy calls and says the store is all right. It doesn't stop me from tensing up every time the news mentions a business that's been attacked. The news does more than give Khalil's name now. They show his picture, too. They only call me the witness. Sometimes the 16-year-old black female witness. The police chief appears on screen and says what I was afraid he'd say.
We have taken into consideration the evidence as well as the statement given by the witness, and as of now, we see no reason to arrest the officer.
Mama and Seven glance at me. They don't say anything with Sakani right here. They don't have to. All of this is my fault. The riots, gunshots, tear gas, all of it are ultimately my fault. I forgot to tell the cops that Khalil got out with his hands up. I didn't mention that the officer pointed his gun at me. I didn't say something right, and now that cop's not getting arrested. But while the riots are my fault, the news basically makes it sound like it's Khalil's fault he died.
There are multiple reports that a gun was found in the car, the anchor claims. There is also suspicion that the victim was a drug dealer as well as a gang member. Officials have not confirmed if any of this is true.
The gun stuff can't be true. When I asked Khalil if he had anything in the car, he said no. He also wouldn't say if he was a drug dealer or not. And he didn't even mention the gang-banging stuff. Does it matter, though? He didn't deserve to die. Sakani and Rick start breathing deeply around the same time, fast asleep. That's not an option for me with the helicopters, the gunshots, and the sirens. Mama and Seven stay up, too. Around 4 in the morning when it's quieted down, Daddy comes in, bleary-eyed and yawning.
They didn't hit Marigold,
he says, between bites of pot roast at the kitchen table.
Looks like they're keeping it mostly on the east side, near where he was killed. For now, at least.
For now. Mama repeats. Daddy runs his hand over his face.
Yeah, I don't know what's gonna stop them from coming this way. Shit, much as I understand it, I dread it if they do.
We can't stay here, Maverick, she says, and her voice is shaky, like she's been holding something in this entire time and is just now letting it out. This won't get better. It'll get worse. Daddy reaches for her hand. She lets him take it, and he pulls her onto his lap. Daddy wraps his arms around her and kisses the back of her head.
We'll be all right.
He sends me and Seven to bed. Somehow I fall asleep. Natasha runs into the store again.
Star, come on!
Her braids have dirt in them, and her once fat cheeks are sunken. Blood soaks through her clothes. I step back. She runs up to me and grabs my hand. Hers feels icy, like it did in her coffin.
Come on, she tugs at me. Come on!
She pulls me toward the door, and my feet move against my will.
Stop, I say. Natasha, stop!
A hand extends through the door, holding a Glock.
Bang!
I jolt awake. Seven bangs his fist against my door. He doesn't text normal, and he doesn't wake people up normal either.
We're leaving in 10.
My heart beats against my chest like it's trying to get out. You're fine, I remind myself. It's Seven, stupid butt.
Leaving for what?
I ask him.
Basketball at the park. It's the last Saturday of the month, right? Isn't this what we always do?
But the riots and stuff.
Like Pop said, that stuff happened on the east. We're good over here. Plus the news said it's quiet this morning.
What if somebody knows I'm the witness? What if they know that it's my fault that cop hasn't been arrested? What if we come across some cops, and they know who I am?
It'll be all right,
Seven says, like he read my mind.
I promise. Now get your lazy butt up so I can kill you on the court.
If it's possible to be a sweet asshole, that's Seven. I get out of bed and put on my basketball shorts, LeBron jersey, and my 13s, like Jordan wore before he left the Bulls. I comb my hair into a ponytail. Seven waits for me at the front door, spinning the basketball between his hands. I snatch it from him, like he know what to do with it.
We'll see about that.
I holler to let Mama and Daddy know we'll be back later, and leave. At first, Garden Heights looks the same. But a couple of blocks away, at least 5 police cars speed by. Smoke lingers in the air, making everything look hazy. It stinks, too. We make it to Rose Park. Some King Lords sit in a gray Escalade across the street, and a younger one's on the park merry-go-round. Long as we don't bother them, they won't bother us. Rose Park occupies a whole block, and a tall chain-link fence surrounds it. I'm not sure what it's protecting, the graffiti on the basketball court, the rusting playground equipment, the benches that way too many babies have been made on, or the liquor bottles, cigarette butts, and trash that litter the grass. We're right near the basketball courts, but the entrance to the park is on the other side of the block. I toss the ball to 7 and climb the fence. I used to jump down from the top, but one fall and a sprained ankle stop me from doing that again. When I get over the fence, 7 tosses the ball to me and climbs. Khalil, Natasha, and I used to take a shortcut through the park after school. We'd run up the slides, spin on the merry-go-round till we were dizzy, and try to swing higher than one another. I try to forget all that as I check the ball to 7. First to 30?
40,
he says. Knowing damn well he'll be lucky if he gets 20 points. He can't play ball just like Daddy can't play ball. As if to prove it, 7 dribbles using the palm of his hand. You're supposed to use your fingertips. Then this fool shoots for a 3. The ball bounces off the rim, of course. I grab it and look at him. Weak! You knew that shit wasn't going in.
Whatever. Play the damn game.
5 minutes in, I have 10 points to his 2, and I basically gave him those. I fake left, make a quick right in a smooth crossover, and go for the 3. That baby goes in nicely. This girl's got game. 7 makes a T with his hands. He pants harder than I do, and I'm the one who used to have asthma.
Time out. Water break.
I wipe my forehead with my arm. The sun glares on the court already. How about we call it?
Hell no. I got some game in me. I gotta get my angles right.
Angles? This is ball 7, not selfies.
Hey, yo!
Some boy calls. We turn around and my breath catches. Shit. There are 2 of them. They look 13-14 years old. And are wearing green Celtics jerseys. Garden disciples, no doubt. They cross the courts, coming straight for us. The tallest one steps to 7.
Nigga, you kingin'?
I can't even take this fool seriously. His voice squeaks. Daddy says there's a trick to telling OGs from young G's, besides their age. OGs don't start stuff. They finish it. Young G's always start stuff.
Nah, I'm neutral,
7 says.
And King your daddy?
The shorter one asks.
Hell no. He just messing with my mama.
It don't even matter.
The tall one flicks out a pocket knife.
Hand your shit over. Sneakers, phones, everything.
Rule of the garden. If it doesn't involve you, it doesn't have shit to do with you. Period. The King Lords in the Escalade see everything going down. Since we don't claim their set, we don't exist. But the boy on the merry-go-round runs over and pushes the GDs back. He lifts up his shirt, flashing his piece.
We got a problem?
They back up.
Yeah, we got a problem,
the shorter one says.
You sure? Last time I checked, Rose Park was King territory.
He looks toward the Escalade. The King Lords inside nod at us, a simple way of asking if things are cool. We nod back.
Aye, the tall GD says. We got you.
The GDs leave the same way they came. The younger King Lord slaps palms with 7.
You straight, bruh? He asks.
Yeah. Good looking out, Vontae.
I can't lie. He's kind of cute. Hey, just 'cause I...